Money Show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest for this portion of WGTD's morning show is Dr. David Geyer, who is a highly regarded orthopedic surgeon and sports medicine specialist, who not only helps young athletes to recover from their injuries, but also helps the rest of us understand the nature of such injuries, the ways in which such serious injuries perhaps can be avoided, or the risk at least can be lessened, and helps us understand the reality of what an athlete, especially an elite athlete, is facing in trying to come back from what are often devastating injuries, and injuries that once upon a time would have meant the end of their career. But now, with the wonders of modern medicine, it is possible for many athletes to return to the field, to the court, and in some cases, even return to achieve every bit the excellence that they had achieved even before their injury. Dr. Geyer's new book is called That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever, in which he examines a number of specific athletes and specific injuries which they suffered, which really helped sort of change the game in the sense of helping us understand the nature of certain injuries and what it means to come back from such devastating injuries. And it's a very, very interesting book published by 4EDGE. Dr. David Geyer, we welcome you to the morning show.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. I'm curious if you came into the field of sports medicine as an athlete yourself, and if that's one reason why all of this is so interesting to you, or were you simply drawn to medicine and then for no particular reason drawn to the arena of sports medicine specifically?
Well, I was an athlete. I wouldn't call myself a terrific athlete. I didn't play, obviously, in the pros or even at the college level. I did play travel soccer and a variety of other sports, and still like to be active now, lift weights every day and do a variety of other things. So in a lot of ways, I still consider myself an athlete. I just don't get paid to do it.
Hmm. You begin your really interesting book with an event that occurred back in 1970. And as we first begin reading it, we have no idea the particular person you are talking about or the particular incident. And the longer we read it, the more it starts to become clear which moment in sports you are talking about. And it's not an elite athlete in the sense of anybody that any of us have heard of, and yet it's somebody that just about all of us have seen. Explain to our listeners how your book begins and why you chose to begin it this way.
Yeah, I think that's great. It's a name, you're right, nobody knows, a guy named Vinko Bogataj, and I probably I may be mispronouncing that. He was a Slovenian ski, I think they, now it's basically, they call it ski flying back then, but it's what we think of with the downhill skiing, the ramps, the ski jumping. And he was the legendary crash on the wide world of sports. And, you know, the agony of defeat guy, his crash follows those words. And I chose him because wide world of sports sort of paralleled the explosion in sports in terms of the prominence in society with 24/7 cable sports coverage and talk radio and the internet. But it also was a moment that had a tremendous impact on the sport. You don't think much of that one ski jumper basically having a crash, and you think it's interesting and you hate it for him, but we never really heard what happened to him. He really did not suffer that significant of an injury. He had a concussion, but he was fine. But it had a devastating impact on the sport of ski jumping. Basically, that footage being shown week after week convinced parents that the sport was really unsafe, and basically it really went away largely in the United States. There were other factors, but that's what I wanted to show in this book, how one injury could have a tremendous impact, both positive and negative, on the sports and on the athletes.
Right. In this case, perhaps dissuading certain people from pursuing a sport that looked very, very dangerous. If all you know about this sport is this infamous bit of film footage, and of course in other cases, your book explores ways in which a particularly devastating injury helped maybe change the way the rules were written for a sport, or the way in which equipment was designed to safeguard the well-being of the athletes, and in some cases we are talking about sports injuries that perhaps helped to prompt or helped bring into focus new ways of treating such a devastating injury. That's a part of the way in which we learn about one of the greatest female runners of all time, the great Joan Benoit, who won the first gold medal for women's marathon running at the Olympics. That was back in 1984. But not long before that, Joan Benoit had suffered a very, very serious knee injury. Explain what made her injury so serious and what made the treatment of it, in a sense, so groundbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a fascinating story. She was training, as you say, for the first ever women's marathon in the Olympics, training for the Olympic trials. She was the world record holder at the time and was easily going to win that. And started developing this pain in her knee that was not getting better. She was seeing doctors all over the country, getting all these treatments, getting shots in her knee, and nothing was working. And so she saw a doctor that was affiliated with Nike who sponsored Benoit, and he said, hey, we've got one last thing to try. Let's scope your knee. Let's do an arthroscopic knee surgery, which was fairly novel at the time. It seems so commonplace now. But basically, he was able to look in through small incisions with a camera, find the source of the pain, and take care of it. And she was able to compete 17 days later after that surgery and win the marathon trials, which even today would be unheard of, to be able to compete at that level 17 days after arthroscopic knee surgery. But that raised so much attention. It really put arthroscopic surgery on the map. And now it's one of the most common surgeries in all of medicine.
Hmm. You also go on from there to tell the story of a legendary basketball player by the name of Bernard King, and his return after a devastating ACL injury, and essentially what you say in this chapter is that not long before that, this kind of injury would have really spelled the end of such an athlete's career. Or at the very best, they might have limped back and hobbled around playing maybe at a third of the level that they played before. And so Bernard King's comeback was quite extraordinary. Explain how such a comeback was possible.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And before Bernard King's time, doctors, we would put patients in casts and let their knee become stable, but it would get really stiff, and you just can't play sports at a high level with a stiff knee, and so it ended their careers. Bernard King was determined to not have that happen, so he underwent a surgery that has become very common, but then a grueling rehab over a couple of years, getting his motion back, getting his strength back, and he got back to play at an all-star level. He made the all-star game. He was the first elite athlete to be able to do that, and it really set the way now for, you know, basically all athletes expect to be able to get back to play at the same level. And it's not just pro athletes, even though we have good success rates at that level, but it's high school kids, college kids, even younger than that, and then adults that just like to play sports and exercise. Now 100 to 150,000 Americans get that surgery every year, and because of the changes, the advances we've made, we can expect that they're going to get back to do what they love to do.
We're speaking with Dr. David Guyer about his book, That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever. By the way, I wanted you to share with our listeners one really beautiful moment from this chapter about Bernard King. And it really underscores how grateful he was to the doctor that had helped make his comeback possible. Tell our listeners about Bernard King's ability to return and make the All-Star team and the gesture which he made upon that occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really great. So Bernard King, everybody told him that there's no chance he's ever going to get back to play, but for good reason. Nobody really did before him. But, you know, he had a terrific surgeon, Dr. Norman Scott, who is the doctor of his team, the New York Knicks, and his physical therapist, Dania Switzer, who he would basically see 5 days a week at his house. She would drive from Manhattan into New Jersey to work with him every single day for well over a year. And the three of them, they worked so hard. And to be fair, he makes the comment, really, they were the only three that thought it was possible that he could play again in the NBA. So when he made the All-Star team, he brought Dr. Scott, he brought Dania Switzer and her husband to the All-Star game, gave them signed basketballs, because he was so grateful that basically it was just the three of them that believed he could do it, and sure enough, he did.
Hmm. Yeah, I like the way he says something to the effect that there were three people. It was the culmination of a dream that only three people thought possible, and of course, one of those three was Dr. Norman Scott, who was there to cheer him on. Your book goes on to explore the stories of a number of different athletes and various injuries, and for the most part, we're talking about, you know, sort of the stories of what we've just recounted with these first two. But in some cases, we're talking about injuries that sort of give us access to more overarching questions. And I wanted to take a little bit of time to talk about this. In Chapter 8, where you are really exploring the notion of medical evaluation and clearance of athletes to play. And in the chapter, I think, that comes right after that about Michael Jordan, where we're talking about the question of how an athlete can and should decide whether or not to return to play. I mean, at what point is it better for me to get out there and play again? Let's talk first about the whole matter of medical evaluation and clearance. I think your chapter here really underscores how tricky a matter this is, and really crucially important too. Tell us the story of this particular athlete and how it sort of raises this really intriguing issue.
Yeah, so I start the chapter talking about Sam Bowie, who probably not a real household name unless you're a diehard NBA fan, but he was the player drafted right before Michael Jordan in the 1984 NBA draft, and it's widely regarded to be the worst draft pick of all time, one, because Jordan became the best player ever to play, but Sam Bowie also couldn't stay healthy. He had multiple injuries, and during college, he missed 2 years of college because of a stress fracture in his leg, and it explores the whole question of, is that something that the team and the doctors should have been able to predict? Could he have a problem that was not going to keep him from staying healthy? And Portland, the team that drafted Sam Bowie, has a history of drafting multiple players that just haven't been able to stay healthy, Bill Walton and Greg Oden and Brandon Roy. And so it explores the whole question of, you know, how do we tell? You know, if they've had an injury, how do we know they've fully recovered? Yes, we can get x-rays, and now we get MRIs, and we can. There's lots of things we can do, but we can't see pain, and we can't necessarily predict the future. There's a lot of analytics going on right now, a lot of studying of statistics to get to where we can predict these injuries and how well that's going to predict how, if a, you know, basically an athlete can play, can stay on the court, stay on the field. But at the end of the day, with millions and millions of dollars on the line, you know, these, if you're wrong, I mean, it's devastating for a franchise, and it's really, like you say, very tricky to figure out, despite our best tests and surgeries.
Mm. Yeah, and you really don't envy the doctor who is placed in that position. I mean, you certainly don't envy the athlete either, but you really don't envy the doctor who shoulders the responsibility of clearing an athlete to play. And yes, I like in your this chapter about Sambui, this sort of irony that there was actually Michael Jordan who suffered an injury quicker than Mr. Bowie did, and there were at least a few people who were saying, wow, it's a good thing we drafted Sambui instead of Michael Jordan. And then, of course, Michael Jordan eventually goes on to this long and extraordinary career, and Sambui just can't quite stay healthy. Really underscores for all that an athlete can do to remain healthy and be in the best shape that can possibly be, it's about more than that, and it's a capricious thing, and sometimes good luck and bad luck has at least some role to play in this.
Yeah, it really does, unfortunately. And that gets to sort of the bigger picture, too, and I write about this later on in the book about how does this apply to all of us, that we just love to play sports and exercise. And I think it stresses points like getting your injuries checked out by a doctor early and not trying to push through it to make sure it's not something serious. It talks about taking enough time to rehab to make sure you're 100%, and then it introduces the concepts of at what point do we, after so many injuries or so many aches and pains, do we say, hey, maybe I shouldn't do this anymore? You know, these guys, you know, I talk about Bill Walton in the Sambui chapter, had 37 surgeries. You know, at what point do we say, hey, you know, we got to stop and stop putting the wear and tear on our bodies? But yeah, you're right. If the guys that can stay healthy, the adults listening to this, that, you know, if they can stay healthy, you know, that's great for being able to play with your kids and being able to run in your 60s and 70s. And we're getting better in the sports medicine world at helping people do that. But you're right. A lot of it is dependent on luck and your body makeup.
Right. And of course, as we said, you explore this question of when should an athlete return to play in a chapter devoted to the great Michael Jordan, one of the great legends. The Bulls won 6 NBA championships. He was league MVP 5 times, NBA Finals MVP 6 times, a 14-time All-Star. And yet he found himself, although he certainly did not have an injury-ridden career, he couldn't have done what he did. On the other hand, Michael Jordan faced all kinds of injuries during that long career and over again had to sort of figure out the best way for him to listen to his own body.
And that was really a source of concern of his during, especially early in his career when he had the fracture in his foot that caused him to miss about half a season. He did listen to his body and said, look, I feel fine, I can play. But the doctors and the team held him out for many, many weeks after that. And it's interesting because that's sort of the opposite of what we hear now. These players at the pro level feel that doctors are trying to rush them back before they're healed because the team needs them to play and the fans, you know, they make money on the fans and ticket sales. And so there's these stories about how pro athletes don't trust their doctors. So it's an interesting sort of dilemma in terms of, you know, communication between the doctor and the athlete and the team and trying to figure out what's best, yes, you know, for short term, getting somebody back to play, but it doing it in a way that doesn't risk shortening an athlete's career and hurting their long-term health. And it's really a tricky problem, more than you would really think. And so I go into that in a lot of detail because we, at the end of the day, have to keep these guys healthy, not just so they can play longer and make money longer, but so they can play with their kids and be active later in life.
It's also important for us to acknowledge that sometimes injury and other issues can not only lead to devastation later in life, such as what we've heard so much about with head injuries, perpetual head injuries that can really cause long-term brain damage, which you explore in a chapter about Dave Duerson. But also there are those rare instances in which we are even sometimes talking about an athlete's life tragically coming to an abrupt end. You talk about that in a chapter about a member of the Minnesota Vikings named Corey Stringer. And some of our listeners, at least, I'm sure, remember this tragic story of Corey Stringer dying after collapsing due to heat stroke. Say a word about this and how we can safeguard against such tragedies from recurring.
Yeah, it was devastating. It was basically, and you don't think of Minnesota being somewhere that's really hot, but it was in the, you know, close to 100 degrees, really hot humidity in training camp, and the players are in, you know, pads and helmets, and he basically started overheating, had, you know, went into heat stroke where he became confused. And by the time the ambulance got there and they got him to the hospital, his temperature was over 108 degrees, and they couldn't save him. What's important about it is that that's largely a preventable problem, both from hydration and getting gradually used to hot and humid conditions with adding longer practices and two-a-days and adding in equipment slowly, and that's really been implemented, especially at the high school and college level, but also recognizing heat stroke and starting immediate treatment on site, not waiting for the ambulance to take them to the hospital, but do the ice water baths and things on site. And we've gotten to where we can pretty much eliminate any player dying if the right steps are taken, but it still happens 5 to 10 times a year. So while it is preventable, which is a really good thing, we still have to get the awareness out there, the education out there to keep these athletes alive.
At the end of your book, I think one of the things you touch on in your conclusion is that these breakthroughs in medical science can help us keep our athletes safe and can make comebacks possible that a few years ago would have been absolutely inconceivable. Sort of the double edge of it is it makes fans of sports and athletes themselves also perhaps tempted to be impatient or to have outsized expectations about what is possible. We still have to be careful. We still have to listen to our own bodies.
You're absolutely right. I mean, these concepts still apply to all of us. You know, listen to our bodies, not trying to push through pain, get it checked out. But it's also leading to, are we going to follow the path of the pros who are willing to try treatments like stem cells and PRP that are sort of unproven right now and not paid for by insurance? What's the role of that for us, that we just like to lift weights or run? I think that it's an exciting times in terms of what we're going to be able to do to heal active people. But there's still a lot of questions we have to answer if we're going to keep people healthy into their 60s and 70s.
This is a very, very interesting book. 13 different athletes are profiled and their stories, including the Tommy John surgery that is so well known in baseball, and as we mentioned earlier, the long-term effects of brain damage for football players and for other athletes, for that matter, the dangers of extreme sports and so on. So much is explored in such thoughtful fashion in this book called That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever, published by 4EDGE, and the author, Dr. David Geyer. Dr. Geyer, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule for this conversation. I enjoyed this. Best wishes.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
The time is 8:34. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. In this portion of the morning show, we're going to be looking back at the single game which transformed NFL football here in America more than any other game. We're talking about the championship game played back in 1958 between the Baltimore Colts and the New York Giants. It was a game which was nationally televised, and it helped bring NFL football front and center into American cultural life. Mark Bowden, a highly regarded author of a number of different bestsellers, wrote a book several years ago about this important game and this seminal moment in NFL history. That book is titled The Best Game Ever, Giants vs. Colts, 1958, and the Birth of the Modern NFL. I wonder, ahead of you beginning work on this, how much did you know about this game? And what in particular drew you to it as the subject for a new book?
Well, I knew of the game. It obviously is one of the most famous in NFL history. And I grew up the latter part of my childhood in Baltimore, so I knew this team. And, of course, I heard a lot about this game. I was a little too young to have seen it myself. So I was always interested in it. The idea of writing this book was actually proposed to me by my publisher, Morgan Entrekin, several years ago after I had finished writing Guest of the Ayatollah. He knew that I was a football fan. I'd written a book some years ago about the Philadelphia Eagles in 1992 called Bringing the Heat. I was a football writer for a brief period in my experience as a newspaper reporter. So this was an opportunity to return both to a subject matter that interested me and also a piece of my own past.
It's intriguing to write about something which is 50 years in the past, unlike, for instance, Guests of the Ayatollah, the Iranian hostage crisis, which is about half as many years in our past as this football game. As you sought to connect with some of the principal players, I'm using that term in a couple of different ways, of course, who were part of this game, it had to be frustrating to know that some of them were already gone.
It's true. You know, but I think roughly half of the men who played in this game are still around, and I was able to track down most of them. I was frankly surprised and delighted that so many of them were still around, and they were, you know, extremely helpful. But it is true that my work does seem to be regressing deeper and deeper into the past. And as you move further back into the past, obviously you, by necessity, have to rely more and more on documentary evidence and the record. So I get a great deal of pleasure out of researching old newspaper files and looking for artifacts like, say, the audio recording of the NBC broadcast of this football game. And it's really, it's a little bit like a treasure hunt. You go off in search of documentation for the thing that you're going to write about, and every once in a while you really strike gold.
I think I've touched on the fact that this game was nationally telecast, but you tell us, or at least imply, that absolutely nothing of this game survives in terms of any footage from that telecast.
That's right. There's no footage of the actual television broadcast, but there are a smattering of films of the game. NFL Films made a documentary 25 years ago about this game, which has some really terrific black and white footage shot on the sidelines. It was not from the television broadcast. It was from someone operating a camera on the sidelines, even though NFL Films didn't exist in 1958. And then there was, of course, what's called the coaches' film, which is NFL teams all utilize film to study their opponents and to prepare for their next football game. And so this game, like every game, was filmed from a vantage point high over the 50-yard line where you can see all of the players on the field, virtually the entire field. It's very useful for study purposes. It's nothing at all like or nearly as exciting as the footage that you watch on a television broadcast. But for coaches who are looking to study plays and formations and strategy, the coach's film is actually a more useful tool.
So how much of this game exists on film? I mean, even if it is from a kind of a distant, frustrating vantage point, as you just described, I mean, do we have all or nearly all or a substantial portion of this game on film?
The entire game is on film.
Really?
And I was very fortunate to recruit the help of Philadelphia Eagles head coach Andy Reid, who, out of the goodness of his heart and out of his own curiosity, sat with me for hours dissecting that coach's film, which is, of course, what he does for a living. And his insights into the strategies of the teams, the formations, the abilities of the players was invaluable to me and really informed my analysis of the whole game in the book.
You mentioned the fact that the radio broadcast, I think you said, over NBC also exists. And indeed, that broadcast is quoted throughout the course of your book, including once in a while interesting mistakes, as sometimes occur in live broadcast.
That's right. You know, I used the radio broadcast to try to capture some of the excitement and immediacy of the game. We're all used to watching football games with commentary. It's just part of the experience. And so to have that instant explanation and reaction on a recording was invaluable to me, I think, in trying to capture the atmosphere. And yes, that does occasionally come with the mistakes that broadcasters make, having to, you know, unravel a complicated, fast-moving game very quickly.
I wanted to mention one other thing that you mentioned very much in passing in the introduction. You called this game between the Giants in their dark blue helmets and the single red stripe and blue wool jersey and the white numbers and the Baltimore Colts with the horseshoe emblem on their white helmets and badly soiled whites with blue numbers and trim. You called this a colorful spectacle for those present, but for the far bigger part of its audience, the most celebrated game in football history would be remembered primarily in black and white. And I think that's so interesting because even if all we've ever seen is are still photos of this game, I've only seen photographs of this game in black and white, and it never really stopped. I never stopped to think about how I only think of this in black and white. And
right.
It's interesting how that changes our view of it and in some ways even heightens our sense of the drama that played out that day stretching into the evening.
It's true, and there's a reason why Hollywood filmmakers really enjoyed and exploited the shadows and light in sort of the monochrome of black and white film to make these wonderful film noir classics. And it isn't just the fact that this game was seen primarily in black and white, because black and white was the only kind of televisions around in 1958 for the most part, but the fact that the game was played late in the afternoon and spilled over into the evening, into night, and the lighting in Yankee Stadium, where night games were not as common as they are today, was not as effective as it is. If you go to a night game, football or baseball today, the whole arena is illuminated like it's noon. But back in 1958, the lights were very adequate for lighting up the field, but they didn't light up the stands. And so what that meant when you looked at this black and white picture on your television was you had a brightly illuminated field of play and a stark black backdrop, as though someone had just lowered a black curtain, which I think made the action appear all that more dramatic and memorable.
You say many of the viewers, meaning now the viewers of the telecast, just beginning to tune in, were not regular watchers of pro football, and they were seeing something starkly different than the traditional college games played on sunny autumn afternoons. This was more like mortal combat from some dark underworld, as in some medieval rite, the players on both sidelines were draped in long capes. A master cinematographer could not have lit the scene more dramatically. We're speaking with Mark Bowden about his wonderful book called The Best Game Ever, which is a look at the NFL Championship game of 1958. just ahead of us talking specifically about the game, I want to return to the matter of your encounters with many of the principal players involved in this game, literally some of the players on the field and also others who were important participants. You tell us at one point in the book that one of the most extraordinary things about this game is that when you consider the players on the field and the coaches on the sideline and how many future members of the NFL Hall of Fame were on the field or in that stadium, it truly is a constellation of incredible greatness playing out here.
It's true. There were 17 future members of the Hall of Fame, and it was certainly the greatest assembly of talent ever in a professional football game. And what's more interesting about it, even just than the fact that all these great players and coaches and owners were there, but that the reason that so many of these players and coaches went on to the Hall of Fame is that they were really at the vanguard of the evolution of the game of pro football. So, for instance, you had as the two assistant coaches for the New York Giants, Vince Lombardi on the offense and Tom Landry coaching the defense. Well, they were young coaches then. They had yet to develop their own style. And, of course, Lombardi went off to Green Bay and created the great dynasty of the Green Bay Packers. And Landry went off to Dallas to create his own dynasty there. The reason that they went on to such heights is that they were innovators who were stretching the strategies and tactics of football in new directions. And, you know, the success that they would have later on is just testament to how innovative they were. And a lot of those the budding approaches that they were taking are visible in this game.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that about half of these players are still alive, and many of them you were able to speak to, and that's, of course, one of the things that enriches this book immeasurably. I wonder, sometimes as people look back on events from 50 years before, the memories are clouded, or perhaps they see things very much from their own perspective and not that of others. Can you give us any general reaction to the experience of speaking with these men about this big day from so much earlier in their lives, the clarity of their recollection, and maybe the wisdom with which they were able to look at these events now?
You know, it varied greatly, and it's really interesting to see how. I mean, on the one hand, on one extreme, you had Raymond Berry, who is a very cerebral football player and coach, and who's someone who kept meticulous notes, which he prepared actually before the game and has sort of made a study of football all of his life. He remembers this football game from 50 years ago as though he played it yesterday. And he has the advantage of all of his notes to jog his memory. And on the other extreme, you have a wonderful character like Fatso, Artie Donovan, who has been dining out on his wit and his humorous anecdotes about his days as a pro football player for a half century. And his memories of this game are rich and colorful, but are not always exactly true. You want to tell Artie's stories the way he tells them, though, just because they're so artfully and comically prepared. But you have to go back to the record to make sure that Artie remembers things exactly. Some guys, like Ordell Bracy, a really bright guy, has nevertheless misremembered certain key aspects of the game and has no doubt remembered them incorrectly for so long now that they are just, you know, they've become his memory. But the film of the game and the radio broadcast contradict him in certain key areas. So it is really interesting.
You, of course, were too late to be speaking directly to, for instance, the Colts quarterback Johnny Unitas, who passed away several years ago. And of course, there are a number of players who are now gone, but of course you also had a rich legacy of all the interviews which many of these important players did.
Right.
And over again, of course, this would be a game they would be asked about repeatedly.
Yep. And it's almost always the case when I write a book or a story about something that includes, you know, certain very famous people, if I can't have access to those people either because they refuse to be interviewed or they've deceased, generally they're the least significant people for me to not be able to meet personally, because simply because, as you say, they've been interviewed so many times in the past. So Johnny Unitas's recollections of this game have been written about and analyzed and pored over for a half century, whereas somebody like Al Berry, who played offensive line for the New York Giants, I doubt that, you know, more than two or three people have ever interviewed Al at any length about his memories of the game. So he was more valuable, frankly, to me.
Hmm. One person that I wish you had come along soon enough to interview would be Alan Ameche. And I say that because for the many listeners to this program who are from Kenosha, Wisconsin, they would have, of course, dearly loved to have heard even more about this great running back. Of course, you talk about him in the pages of your book, and he is one very colorful character indeed in this drama.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is, and he, you know, a great lover of opera, which was a sort of an unusual taste for a football player. A really bright guy who, in addition to his athletic ability, proved to be an extraordinarily astute businessman and investor who made millions when he left football. I think one of the revelations in this book about Alan Ameche, which I've never seen reported anywhere else, is how disgruntled he was playing for Weeb Eubank, his head coach. Eubank, who used a method of motivation for some players who he didn't particularly like, which he called needling, began needling poor Alan Ameche right after he joined the football team. And Ameche cut his career fairly short. He only played for 6 years, even though he was a tremendous success in pro football. And a lot of people have wondered why he bowed out quite so early. And one of the reasons was that he did not like playing for Weeb Eubank. And, of course, at the time it wasn't very easy for players to change teams.
Let's talk about 1958 and what made this such an important time for the game of football. You say in 1958, professional football, the league and its audience, were on the cusp of an explosion. Tell us the state of affairs leading up to 1958. What was professional football like in this era? And how was it perceived? So we can better understand then the catalyst of change that this game in 1958 proved to be.
Well, of course, pro football had been around for about 30 years and had been growing in popularity throughout the 20th century. It was really the advent of television and the sort of merger of television and football, which occurred most dramatically in this game, that launched pro football. But basically, prior to the sort of the boom years of the 1950s, baseball was the only really major sport in America. It was the national pastime, and it really dominated the leisure time and interests of the American people. But as the wealth of our society grew and people had more and more leisure time, there was a great deal of interest, growing interest in sports as both a recreational activity and as something to watch. And this, of course, this growth in leisure time and interest in sports was happening at the same time that television was maturing and every household in America was getting a television set. So what was about to happen was a sort of explosion, not just of football, but of really sports in general. I mean, you have the creation of professional hockey leagues and basketball, and of course today, you know, there's many more sports that occupy America's interest. Of all these, football is the most successful and is the one that has best exploited television, and I think it's because, you know, football is an ideal sport for a television broadcast.
I would like you to explain that just a little bit further. You talk about the game's inherent appeal and what you call its neat fit with TV, and that you put those two things together, and pro football and the public were just bound to fall in love with one another. And of course, 1958 is the moment that that happens. Just explain for a moment why football is such a perfect fit with television. What is it exactly about the game?
Well, George Will sort of famously and disparagingly described football as combining two of the worst aspects of American culture, violence and punctuated by committee meetings. And that is true. But the reason that those things are so popular in America is because they're fascinating. You know, a football game takes place on a big field, but before every play, all of the players huddle. They decide what they're going to do next, which builds suspense. And then they all line up in a very compact formation, which fits fairly neatly within the binds of a television set. And on the snap of the ball, they execute this play, which takes place over, you know, rapidly, very fast. There are a lot of players, and 22 players in motion. And frankly, it's pretty difficult for someone sitting in the stands of a football game to fully understand what has just happened on any given play. With football, because there's this delay between plays, it gives television nowadays, especially with the tools of slow motion replay and isolated cameras, and of course the commentary of expert football watchers, in the period between plays, you know, we basically what happens is television sorts out the action for us. It isolates the key players. Sometimes nowadays, the analysts will actually draw up on a telestrator on your screen exactly what routes players ran. So the game, as the game is being played, television is explicating it for the audience, which of course builds understanding and enhances, I think, the experience of the game. So for all those reasons, television is just an ideal vehicle for the game of football.
Best-selling author Mark Bowden's book is called The Best Game Ever, Giants versus Colts 1958 and the Birth of the Modern NFL, published by Grove Press. And now it's time to look at what's going to be coming up next week on The Morning Show here on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Coming up on Monday, an interview I'm really excited to share with you. It's with a gentleman by the name of Finn Murphy, and his book is called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. Finn Murphy is a very intelligent and articulate gentleman who happens to be a truck driver, and he specializes in long-haul moving. So when people move across the country, Finn Murphy is someone you might call to pack up your stuff and move it all across the country. He has met some interesting people and had some fascinating experiences over that time, and his book is absolutely terrific, and you'll hear my conversation with him on Monday. On Tuesday, we're going to preview for you the Racine Symphony's Lakeside Pops concerts, and this is a special anniversary year for Lakeside Pops, so we're going to be talking with several people involved with Lakeside Pops over the years. Their first concert is coming up next weekend. Wednesday, we'll highlight for you two exciting exhibits at the Chicago Field Museum. One is Jurassic World, inspired by, of course, the movie of the same name. And they also have a very interesting exhibit about tattoos, both here and around the world. On Thursday, Nan Calvert will be here along with Joan Rohr, who is with Adventure Kids Learning. We're going to be talking about helping all of us to better appreciate clean water and how important it is for all of us to contribute to keeping our water clean. And 1 week from today, an interview that initially was scheduled for a week or two ago and had to be rescheduled because it was lost, the lost is found. Michael Cannell, his book is Incendiary: The Psychiatrist, the Mad Bomber, and the Invention of Criminal Profiling. This is a really interesting story of a real-life crime that occurred in Boston in the mid-19th century, and it really reshaped the way criminal cases are investigated to this very day. You'll hear my